Okay. All right. So we have law clerks who would be entitled to see the sealed documents. We have the attorneys for each side. The government lawyer is Joshua Waldman. Is that correct? And then we have for the plaintiff appellants, Heaney Shamsi. Oh, I'm sorry. So do we have that spelled wrong? H-I-N-A? Okay. Now, who do you have seated at council table with you? Okay. But those first two people, who are they? Okay, so we just have lawyers and then seated up here. And then in the audience, the other people that we have, who do we have?
Philip Smith, I'm an attorney for Mr. Carday, related to Motley District.
Okay, I'm not sure you have a right to be here because you don't have access to the sealed documents on this case, do you? Okay, so I'm going to ask you to leave for just right now. I just have to ask the attorney certain things. Okay. And then who else do I have in the audience?
Mr.
Carrier. Mr. Carrier? Okay, you can stay.
I'm Diaz Khan, the president of the Islamic Center.
Okay. Okay, but do you have access to the sealed documents in your capacity? Well, that's the secret documents. Okay, but I'm going to use sealed and secret. Okay, and so the sealed records, the three judges have access to, and the government has access to, but the sealed records, so all of the lawyers would have access to, and the parties would, but I'm a little bit, the ACLU's not a party here, right? Well, you don't have access to the secret stuff, but the sealed stuff, but the ACLU does?
Yes,
because you gave it to them? Not because, can they access it? Do they have, if they just want to go, there's public documents that everyone can look at. All right. Can they look at them that way? I don't think they can they? Right. Okay, but the ACLU isn't co-counsel, right? Okay. Okay, so that's all been shared? Okay, does that sound right to the government? Or I want to have a conversation about the sealed documents, and I don't want anyone in here. And then there's someone back there, too. So you don't have access to the sealed documents, do you? Or are you? Okay, you can come back in after I have this discussion, but I have to ascertain what we can talk about with people in the room and out. Okay, thank you. Okay. I think we've got this. All right. So I'm going to start and say that I'm going to talk about the secret documents first. And the judges, I can represent that the judges have all reviewed the secret documents in SCIF-type situations. We have not conferenced about the secret documents, because as you can see, Judge Fisher is here on video. We come from different locations. So if it becomes, and I talked to the people that the conditions that secret documents have to be looked into, we will not be talking about secret documents after the court proceeding today, other than if we feel we need to convene and discuss them. We don't have the facilities here to, with him on video, with us here, we would not have the facility to do that. So if we decide that as judges we want to talk about the secret documents in our resolution of the case, we will have to make arrangements that we do it so that we're all in secure locations, either by secure phones or as far as that goes. We don't feel it's necessary at this point to have an ex parte with the government today, and we don't have the secure situation to do that. If that came up as part of our decision in the case that we decided we were going to have an ex parte on that, I believe we would notify all the parties that that was going to occur. Now, that doesn't mean that the people that aren't entitled to hear it get to come, but at this point, we've decided we don't need an ex parte at this point. But and today we will not be discussing any of the secret documents in terms of what the contents are, but we've all reviewed them. We've also all reviewed the sealed documents. And so I think I looked at the request here, and so what I have to figure out here is Mr. Carrier has unsealed his documents, it's my understanding. But then the final orders are unsealed as to everyone but Mr. Kashim, I think. That's what I saw in the record. The final orders, yes. I saw somewhere that they were unsealed except for Mr. Kashim.
Mr. Kashim?
I'm sorry.
Let me just check, Your Honor.
Okay, does the government know?
I believe that the final orders were all, the actual decision itself was unsealed as to all of them.
I have that Mr. Did I say, is it Kashim? Did I say
Kashim?
So what I'm trying to ascertain...
Callahan, I'm going to break away from the video a minute, but I can hear you.
Okay, you're still in hearing sight. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, what I'm trying to ascertain in terms of... All right, we've allotted 15 minutes for each side here. And so I'm trying to decide what we can talk. My preference is not to close courtrooms when not necessary. And I've already discussed with the individual that's the clerk of the court here today that we're not going to live stream. But what is in open court after when we go back, we're not going to live stream, but at the end of it, I'll ask, did anyone think that they slipped? And if so, if they didn't, then it will be released after that. But I'm trying to ascertain at this point, if it makes sense, can we proceed in open court for the entire amount, or do we need to set part of it aside to go into a setting where it would just be these individuals that are in the courtroom right here at the end, say like 10 minutes in open court and then 5 minutes to talk about sealed. Because the thing that I noticed is it appears to me that sealed are the, if I understand this correctly, there's obviously a whole challenge to what the program is and the constitutionality of that. But then the individual plaintiffs, appellants, had an offer up of what they would say if there was a hearing. And they were always of the view it had to be a live hearing, which the district court ruled against. And so my understanding is that they only made an offer up, but they didn't actually present those as evidence in a hearing. So I don't know those, if we want to talk about what's in those sealed documents, is that going to be necessary to deciding this? Maybe come up to the podium just so that it's Judge Fisher can hear you.
Certainly, Judge Callahan. So first of all, you are correct that all of the determination letters, except for Plaintiff Kashim, have been unsealed. There is information in the record with everyone, with the exception of Imam Carrier, that remains under seal. It's our position that argument could be had without reference to the sealed information, just the way that it happened in the district court, where we were able to, when it became necessary, refer to the specific parts of the sealed records without disclosing what is in it. However, should the court want to discuss this in any greater detail, of course, we'd be happy to answer questions about that sealed information, but in a closed session.
Okay. Now the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. I essentially agree. I think we can at least try to proceed in an open courtroom. I came prepared to discuss it without revealing the sealed material, but I do understand that often it's difficult to just talk about the legal questions in a vacuum without getting into the facts. So perhaps if we get to a point where you feel like you need to discuss those things to get a better handle on the legal questions, perhaps then we could move to a closed courtroom, but at least start with the presumption of an open courtroom and see. It kind of depends on where your questions would like to go.
Okay, here's what I'm going to propose, is you each have 15 minutes for each side. This is obviously an important case. And you're here by yourself, and over on the plaintiff appellant side, are you going to be doing all the argument?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm going to proceed. We're going to take a short break and reconstitute. We'll reopen the courtroom. I'm going to give you 15 minutes each side, 15 minutes total for the plaintiff appellants and 15 minutes for the government. At the close of this, I'm going to ask both if I'll ask my colleagues if they want to adjourn for 5 minutes on each side for the sealed materials, or if either of you at that point can call to my attention that there's something that you feel like you have to say, then I just don't like to close the courtroom any more than is absolutely necessary. I don't think that's a good idea. So we're going to take a short 10-minute recess. We'll come back out and then do it. Okay. Yes. Yes. We will not live stream. And at the end, if I don't ask you, remind me to ask you, because then it will be live streamed after, unless either of you point out that we had a slip somehow. Okay?
I believe so, yes,
but this is, this we're not going to put out to the public, right? Because I've cleared the courtroom. So. Well, I guess if either of you, if nothing's been said, I guess, are you both okay with that being part of what we release at the end? Okay, I was just doing it with the idea that I'm trying to let you know how to argue the case and how to spend your time, as opposed to, because we do have the secret, the sealed, and then the public record. All right, we'll take a 10-minute recess and then we'll be back on the record.
Yes.
All right, we are back on the record, and the courtroom is open at this point in time. And Mohammed Sheikh Carrier versus Jeff Sessions, 17-35634. Each side has 15 minutes. And while we are recording this proceeding, we have agreed that we're not going to simultaneous stream until such time that at the close of the hearing that we are convinced that we have not spoken of any sealed documents in this process. And as indicated, I will ask both counsel and the judges whether they see any need to go back, I guess, essentially in camera with the group that we had previously to discuss any possible sealed material before we finally submit the case. So we're ready to proceed, and I will begin with counsel for the appellant. Thank you. Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Hina Shamsi for plaintiff's appellants. I'd like to save 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. For 8 years, plaintiffs have been stuck in a Kafkaesque bind. Because the government put them on the no-fly list and stigmatized them, they have suffered and continue to suffer devastating personal and professional harms. They have lost jobs, they have been separated from family members, and they are unable to fulfill religious obligations. This is an indefinite, potentially lifelong ban. Our client, Stephen Washburn, was retained and maintained on the no-fly list. He was separated for years from his wife, who lived in Ireland. Their marriage fell apart. He then got cancer, and he died, still waiting for a fair process to clear his name. Our other clients continue to suffer the harms that I've talked about. They've never been charged, let alone convicted, of any violent crime. The government gave them a process that is unprecedented in modern due process jurisprudence for its unfairness, and it is unnecessary to meet the government's asserted security and secrecy needs. Our clients are left asking, how can you prove yourself innocent of something you have never done and will never do? I'd like to make 2 points.
So we have less, though. We have Carrier, Casham, I don't know, did you say it, Knable?
Knable.
Mishal and Prasad?
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's five plaintiffs.
I know you got 15 minutes, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on background because this has been very well briefed. The first issue you raise is whether the criteria that is used to make this determination by, and this is a fundamental question, TSA or TSC, to put these individuals on the no-fly list, whether that's void for vagueness. In looking at cases that talk about void for vagueness, they're all reviewing statutes or regulations that are published. As best I can tell from the record in this case, this criteria isn't published anywhere. It only exists in a declaration that we got as to what the criteria is. Can you even challenge something that's not published under the void for vagueness criteria? Or is it just inherently vague because they can't find it anywhere? How do you get notice of what you should or shouldn't do?
And that, Your Honor, goes to one of the fundamental issues in the case, which is how much deference do you owe in this particular context? So you wouldn't actually owe the kind of deference that courts give to statutes or regulations that are published after a notice and comment. You're exactly right, Judge Menchevengo, that the criteria here have been revealed in the content in the context of this case, and the government has applied them. Given that the government has applied them to our clients, the vagueness of what the government has done and the criteria that it has used is an issue, and we've challenged it on those grounds because the harm comes from the application of these criteria, as I'll talk about. And very briefly on the vagueness, the core concern here is in many ways boiled down to Justice Gorsuch's concern in his concurrence in DiMaia, which is that vague laws invite arbitrary action. And the government has not defined publicly or anywhere what constitutes a threat. So the kinds of concerns that the Supreme Court was focused on in both Johnson and DiMaia are exactly present here, in that you have the indeterminacy of what it actually means to pose a threat compounded by the indeterminacy of what it means, what kind of risk a person must pose in order to be the threat.
Okay, but they got unclassified summary of the reasons that they were on the no-fly list. So did any of the plaintiffs offer a response to the government's unclassified summary reasons for the no-fly list determinations or ask for a further explanation, and if not, why?
So all of our clients did, in fact, respond to the government's summary of reasons. But, Your Honor, if I may, that
But they did it by an offer of proof, as opposed to they didn't formally do that. So my question is that evidence?
So our clients offered whatever evidence they possibly could, given the deficiencies in the process to which we objected before, as the process was even being put in place. So we asked the government for all of the reasons that our clients had been placed on the list, because it is undisputed that the government wasn't providing all of the reasons. And this actually goes to the due process concern, which is that without all of the reasons, people are left to guess as to why they have actually been put on the no-fly list, and the government may put them back on the no-fly list for undisclosed reasons that people have not had an opportunity to refute.
Well, a lot of your challenges, though, seem to me to make it more like a criminal proceeding, in the sense that you wanted Brady information, that you wanted live hearings and cross-examination, and given the fact that clearly, the government has an interest in combating terrorism and withholding national security information from unauthorized persons, and also your clients have an individual liberty interest to international travel, but we have to balance those. So what standard are you proposing on that? I'm not, you know, having... I don't think any court's ever going to give you everything that the government has. I mean, you may find some court that would, but I kind of seriously doubt that at this particular juncture. So I'm trying to figure out what are you asking for?
Certainly, Your Honor, and your question is calling for about...
It's got a lot. I know. It's got a lot in it.
And if I may address all of the points that you're making. And maybe the best way to do that is to do it in the context of Matthews versus Aldridge and talk through the procedural issues that are at stake. So without belaboring anything, it is clear that our clients have strong liberty interests, and certainly the government has legitimate security concerns and security interests. The government's interests here, though, also have to include an interest against falsely stigmatizing its own citizens and on placing them in an indefinite lifetime ban on a core requirement of modern life without providing them a fair process. And I think when properly understood, the government's interest here with respect to aviation security, because of course this measure is one of a plethora of other measures that the government has available to address its national security concerns, our national security concerns. And what distinguishes this measure is that it is a flying ban. But that concern can actually be accounted for by alternative protocols that the government used in this very case as an alternative to a flying ban, which includes clients providing two or three weeks' notice of an itinerary, of agreeing to fly only on a U.S.-based carrier, arriving at an airport multiple hours in advance for stringent procedures.
But it rarely works on a constitutional challenge to say, you could have done it differently, and here's how I would have liked you to do it. It either is constitutional or it's not, the way that they did it. So, I mean, they don't have to do it the way you want them to do it. They just have to, I mean, obviously the previous plan, or whatever we would call it, was stricken down. And so this is a part two, or it's a revisiting of the,
That's right, Your Honor, but my point here went to how to conceptualize the government's interest at stake, the third Matthews factor, which brings us then to the second factor, right? The additional or different procedures that would guard against error. And here, Your Honor, we're talking about the government's categorical secrecy claims, which the district court upheld based on its novel undue risk to national security standard. And I think it's important to recognize that those claims are actually exaggerated, because the summary of reasons that you referred to, Judge Callahan, is, as the government admits, and this is in pages 284 to 285 of the record, that summary is a summary of unclassified, unprivileged information. So there's no valid reason that the underlying information, which includes our client's own purported statements, statements of third parties, could not have been provided. There may very well be unclassified privileged information, and courts around the country are used to dealing with privileges invoked properly and adjudicated.
But did you actually provide them, or did you just make an offer of proof? So do we have to, because it seemed to me that I couldn't tell if, because you thought that it should be a different type of hearing. So did you choose to not participate in what they offered?
Our clients absolutely participated in what the government offered. We participated under strictures that made the response inadequate from the get-go. And again, the reasons for that, Your Honor, are, one, there wasn't a full statement of reasons. Two, the government was relying, in Imam Karieh's case, for example, on hearsay upon hearsay. It was relying upon statements, it was apparent from that summary, from people who were confidential informants who have motivation for bias. And so the clients put forward, as best they could, a refutation, again, as best they could, without the ability to actually respond to the evidence at issue. And, Your Honor, if I may, going back to the issue of whether the information was classified or not, and all of that information was not classified, it was unprivileged, it should have been provided. But this court in 2012, following the court's decision in Al-Haramain, very pointedly suggested to the district court that it should use the Classified Information Procedures Act type procedures to mitigate against the risk of error. And it is undisputed, because the government hasn't refuted it, that the risk of error in this case is very high. And there is an example in this circuit of how this might have been done. This is in the Ibrahim case, which was before this court twice on jurisdictional and other issues. When it was remanded, it went back down to Judge Alsup in the Northern District of California, and he did something akin to what the district court should have done, which is that he required the government to assert whether it actually was invoking the state secrets privilege. And he determined that the case could go forward without the state secrets privilege. He required the government to invoke privileges, which he adjudicated. He upheld some of them, and he denied others. And then he actually held a trial where it turned out that the plaintiff in that case had been put on the no-fly list as a result of an error made by an FBI agent who was deposed.
So aren't we waiting an en banc decision on that?
No, Your Honor, that case, what Judge Alsup did was make...
No, but Ibrahim.
No, Your Honor. In Ibrahim, I believe you have separate issues on fees, but the issue with respect to the merits has been resolved. And my point here, Your Honor, very simply is that that was a process that was afforded to a non-citizen who was outside of the country. The government would deny that process categorically to our clients, who are all citizens. And
counsel, could I ask a question related to that? If you have a SIPA type proceeding, and you have a clearance as a lawyer, so you are able to engage in the SIPA proceeding, and you would have some access to more than is made public. What would you do with that information if you got it, if you couldn't disclose it to your client or to anybody else? It wasn't clear.
It's a good and difficult question, Judge Fisher. With respect to having information that only cleared lawyers are supposed to have, that even under SEPA proceedings can be exceptional, because under SEPA, the government can be required to provide information that is a summary, an unclassified summary of classified information, so long as due process is guaranteed. There are protective orders that are put in place to which clients can also have information under protected schemes. And then with respect to that, what may very well be a small category of information, well, there's guidance that's provided from the Guantanamo cases where SEPA-like proceedings are applied in a civil context, and where in that circumstance, lawyers are able to address and respond to whatever information the government may have. So the basic point is that there are alternatives to a categorical denial of reasons and evidence. And respectfully, Your Honor, Judge Callahan, we do think that in a case where the issues boil down to disputed facts and credibility, then as the Supreme Court said, and as this court has recognized in V. Singh, a clear and convincing evidence standard and live hearings are absolutely necessary to make that determination. Your Honor, I realize I've run out of
time.
Well,
I'm going to give you a little rebuttal time anyway.
I would like to ask a follow-up question.
Go ahead.
Then, based on Jefferson, the state secret case. When that came to us in bank, we had 11 judges reviewing the confidential material, secret material. And you had 11 appellate judges validating or disagreeing with the government's reasons. So under the jurisdictional provision of this law we're talking about now, if you come to the Court of Appeal after protesting, challenging a TSA ruling, you would have three judges who could review the secret documents, as we have, and you get a legal judgment as to whether the government is denying unconstitutionally the rights of your client. What's wrong with that as a remedy?
If I understand you, may I respond?
Yes, please do.
If I understand you correctly, Judge Fisher, and please correct me if I'm wrong, if your question is with respect to three judges reviewing the ex parte information that the government has provided, we think that that is unnecessary to adjudicate this case, because the district court reviewed it under an undue risk to national security standard, which was error in and of itself. And what the court did in that context was engage in fact-finding herself without providing reasons on the public docket as to why that information could not have been provided, including why withholding of that information could not have been provided. But what's critical here is that, as we understand it, and this is also clear from the government's brief, that ex parte information includes not just classified information, it also includes unclassified information. So it is a categorical broad brush which is being applied. But I don't know if I'm answering your Honor's question fully, and if I'm not, please let me know.
Well, I think your answer was...
I wanted to know if you had... whether we need to do it in this case or not, you have a judicial officer reviewing whether the government has made a proper showing of justification for keeping somebody on the no-fly list.
So, Your Honor, I think what you're making then in that context, if you're talking about, I think your question goes to two issues. One is the propriety of reviewing that information and on the basis of that information making a determination. It is undisputed that the government hasn't provided the reasons for inclusion on the list. And this court in Al Haramain and the Kind Hearts case
I think you're kind of getting off the point. What he's saying, inherent to the process that's before us to determine, at the end of the process, three judges who have already looked at the secret documents, that you have a district judge that's looked at them, you have three judges here, that it is a check on the government's carte blanche ability to claim national security.
And respectfully, Your Honor, we don't think it's enough of a check.
Well, okay, that's what he was asking you. That's why you think that there should be a live hearing. And I don't know whether you envision that there's, maybe think about this, witnesses coming from overseas, would confidential informants be expected to attend, and what would be the consequences if the government refused to produce witnesses based on national security concerns. But so I'll give you 2 minutes on rebuttal. Let's hear from the government.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I'm sorry.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Joshua Waldman from the Department of Justice, representing the appellees. The no-fly list criteria are not unconstitutionally vague. The Supreme Court in Johnson and DiMaia repeatedly said that it is not unconstitutional to use a standard like substantial risk if you judge it against a person's real-world conduct.
Okay, this gets back to, I just have this fundamental problem with the difference between Johnson and DiMaio, which are published regulations that a person can read, and if, in fact, you could ascertain from what you're reading, I should or shouldn't do this because it's putting me on notice that it's prohibited. How does that work with criteria that's not published anywhere? I mean, how would someone, we're starting from that you've already received a notice, you violated this criteria, and here's all the process you need to refute that. But part of the whole notice requirement is to give an ordinary person fair notice of what's prohibited before they engage in the activity, and I don't know how a citizen supposed to know if I do this or I do that, I could end up getting this letter in the mail one day when that criteria isn't published anywhere.
Right. Well, I'd say a couple of things. Number one is the question of vagueness goes to whether it is understandable by a reasonable person. It could be clear or not, and you could have notice of it or not, but whether you have advanced notice doesn't go to the question of clarity. The second of all, when you receive...
But how is it clear if I can't find it? Where would you go to look this up? If I was going to be making a decision about wanting to invest in something or go to something, and I wanted to know, gee, if I do that, is the government gonna think that maybe I'm a suspect terrorist?
Right.
How would I know where to find that?
Well, remember, Your Honor, if you look at the criteria, and we can take a look at it. It's in our brief on page 2. All of these things are about posing a threat of committing certain things that are defined federal crimes. So there may be cases in other instances where you have unpublished requirements.
Couldn't find one.
Excuse me?
Couldn't find one where an ambiguity issue was raised to an unpublished criteria.
Well, there's certainly no argument that the federal crimes that you pose a risk of committing are themselves vague or that people don't have notice of them. And there, if someone had an argument about innocent conduct that people would normally think of as innocent, and they have sort of a reliance interest in saying, well, hey, now something's happening to me, and based on something that nobody would think is anything other than innocent behavior. What I would just do, and we don't want to get into the sealed materials here, but I would urge you to look at the sealed materials and the ex parte.
But again, now we're after the fact. If you've got a criteria that says that you're a threat of engaging in or conducting a violent act of terrorism and operationally capable of doing so, that doesn't tell me anything. That really doesn't tell me anything. It doesn't cite to any definitions. It doesn't send me to any statute. You could certainly say, well, here's what you did, and we think it therefore resembles that. But how would I know that before I did it?
How would you know that you are operationally capable of committing a terrorist act?
Because how am I going to know what you consider an act of terrorism? Until you tell me after the fact, well, this is what you did, and therefore, it just seems to lend itself to ad hoc analysis. Every person's going to be looked at individually and say, well, yeah, look what you did, so clearly you should have known.
Well, I could concede that there may be tough cases on the margin, but the fact that there are tough cases doesn't make a regulation or a statute unclear. And if you want to talk about whether it's clear to them, I mean, one of the best ways, let me just talk about some of the material that's the unsealed material in the record, for example. In the unclassified and unsealed summary for one of the plaintiffs, it talks about his prior conduct as a Mujahideen fighter in Afghanistan, his support for violent jihad, his financial support for people to go to Afghanistan to fight against Americans. That's unsealed, that's unclassified, it's in the record. Now, some hypothetical person somewhere might have a argument to say, how would I know? But there's no way that based on this factual record, someone could make that kind of case. I just thought I was doing innocent conduct.
But you're doing it's as applied to this particular individual. It's not vague. But if it's vague generally, you can't justify it by picking an example and saying, well, that makes it unvague because this person fits in an example. Isn't that exactly what Scalia was saying in Johnson? We don't look at examples to justify the vagueness of a rule because one example could fit in the definition. That doesn't make it not vague.
Well, no, that's not exactly what he said. What he said is you can't defeat an as-applied challenge by saying some conduct somewhere isn't vague, but you can defeat an as-applied challenge by showing the plaintiff's conduct is clearly within the regulation. That's what Humanitarian Law Project said repeatedly. But I go back to, if you want to go back to Johnson and DeMaio, I'm happy to do that, because they said, yes, it can be unclear to figure out what a threat is in some cases, but it is not unconstitutionally vague if that threat is measured by the real-world conduct of the person. And that's precisely what's going on here. And so I don't think there's any Johnson and DeMaio are the beginning and the end of the vagueness challenge in that respect. And I would also note that the criteria that they were listed under is given to them in their response. Now, nobody...
But it's after the fact again.
But the due process challenge here is all after the fact. It's a post-deprivation challenge. It's not a pre-deprivation challenge. Nobody's arguing that there's a due process challenge from the beginning. The question is, after the fact, do you get a chance to reasonably respond? And that's the same with respect to vagueness. Do you know the criteria when you respond? Yes, you do. And post-deprivation is the only argument that's ever been offered here, not pre-deprivation. If I could move on to the...
I want to ask you a question about... We didn't... Section 46.110 and the revised DHS trip procedures give the circuit's initial jurisdiction to hear the plaintiff's substantive process claims. What are the roles of TSC and TSA in making the no-fly list determinations under the revised DHS trip procedures? And does holding that the district court lacks jurisdiction conflict with Ninth Circuit precedent? So I'm a little confused on all of that.
Sure. Let me answer the second question first, if I may. I don't think it conflicts with precedent, although it would change the outcome. The Ibrahim and Lateef precedents were based on the representations in the record about the relative roles of TSC and TSA under the old procedures. And they were based on declarations that were cited by the court first in Ibrahim and then relied upon in Lateef. Now we have a wholly different set of factual circumstances. And so I wouldn't say it's overruling them so much as the factual premises of both of those decisions has changed. And now let me turn to your first question, which is under the revised procedure, when a redress request is made, TSC formulates a recommendation and reasons in support of that and then forwards it to TSA. TSA makes the final substantive decision in that case. And at the record, volume 2 of the ER, page 231, we have a declaration that says TSA, quote, has full authority to order an individual removed from the no-fly list. And then on page 401, the TSA administrator makes the final decision as to whether a U.S. person will be maintained on the no-fly list that's following a redress application. So we think that the factual premise of Ibrahim and Lateef, which was that TSC made the final substantive decision, is no longer correct. And therefore, it's we're now talking about an order of the TSA, and it belongs under 46110, direct review in an appropriate court of appeals.
So it shouldn't be in the district court?
That's correct.
So also, my question is, which I asked of plaintiff slash appellants, on the, is there evidence in the record of, did they participate in the process, or was it an offer of proof, or is it evidence?
Well,
you know, in terms of how we analyze this, let's assume that you get, if we get past the constitutionality, but then we look to their, what does the record support the findings here?
Okay. The plaintiffs did participate in the process. They were sent an initial letter from TSA stating that they were on the no-fly list and giving them an unclassified summary of reasons for that. Then, and telling them they can respond with written information, which they did, and that's all in the record. Largely, it was complaints about the constitutionality of the process rather than a response to the evidence itself. But in some instances, they attempted to rebut some of the information. It was not in the form of, say, sworn declarations under penalty of perjury. But they're entitled to either try that, and some people have done that, not in this case, but then some people just have their lawyers write letters saying our plaintiff contends X, Y, and Z.
Okay, this is like a hypothetical. I'm just trying to okay, let's assume that we said that, and I'm just saying this hypothetically. We haven't conferenced
sure.
on this, but say that they don't get a live hearing, that the process that's set out is constitutional. But then we have to look individually as to each of the people. And so we have the public record, but then their offers of proof for the most part are in the sealed documents. Can it be determined that there were sufficient reasons to keep them on the list without looking at the secret documents?
I believe so.
And probably the one that I would say has the most generic, some are more detailed than others, and probably the least detailed one would be after Mr. Knabel.
Yes. I would think that you would want to, for sure, for all of them, I do think that you'd want to look at the ex parte in camera material, but I think that there are some plaintiffs, for example, the unsealed one of Plaintiff Carrier, I think that alone really ought to be sufficient. But of course, ultimately, if you had any doubts, I think you'd just look at the ex parte submission. I don't think you would have any doubts. But I want to be clear too, since my time is sort of winding down, that this court in Al Haramain was very clear that the government is entitled in these types of circumstances to withhold classified evidence, that SEPA requirements are not required. The court said six or perhaps seven times that an unclassified summary is an acceptable procedure, and you don't have to give information, classified information, even to cleared counsel.
Well, let me just ask you hypothetically, since that was brought up. If the court were to believe that a live hearing were necessary, mm-hmm. let's say that, and that's what the plaintiff appellants are requesting. If the government refused to produce a witness for a live hearing, what's the result there?
That's a tough question. I hope that you wouldn't go to a live hearing, and we have all reasons, but I'm not going to fight the hypothetical.
But I'm just doing the hypothetical.
I think it's possible that if the court ordered us to, say, if, for example, we had to produce cooperating witnesses or someone who was working undercover and reveal them, I suppose it's possible the government could assert state secrets at that point, and perhaps even in the way that Jeppesen talks about, that the case can't proceed if we're ordered to do these types of things. I'm not committing the government. I just want to be clear.
That's one
possibility.
What about a separate proceeding where it's not a live hearing except that whoever's there is a cleared attorney?
In Al Haramain, the court said that the government was not required to do that, that providing an unclassified summary was sufficient to satisfy due process in that case, and emphasized in doing so that the government is not required to do every possible thing to mitigate the risk to the plaintiff of an erroneous decision. It's only required to do what is necessary for a fair and reasonable process. And Al Haramain said 7 times that an unclassified summary was sufficient in those situations. We have the same government interest in combating terrorism, the same government interest in withholding classified information, even from people who might otherwise have clearance. And we have the same...
You're saying that case is binding to say... We can't even entertain the notion of a separate hearing in this case.
I think the way I read Al Haramain is the government could voluntarily adopt SEPA if it wanted to, but is not constitutionally compelled to do so. It can, in the alternative, provide unclassified summaries. And I think that case, Al Haramain, is as close to an on-point analogy as you can get in this. If anything, the private interests were greater in that case than they are in this case, where someone's assets were completely frozen, rendering them financially defunct, which, along with all the other harms that would cause, would obviously mean that they couldn't purchase an airplane ticket to fly anywhere.
Can I ask? I just want
to... Yeah, go ahead.
On the jurisdictional issue.
Sure.
So the TSA is now making the ultimate decision, issuing the order, the yes or no, you're on the list or you're off the list. And so your position is that the substantive challenge, therefore, should have been with the circuit, not with the district court. They wouldn't have jurisdiction, correct?
That's correct.
Do you consider the criteria an order of TSA? I mean, it is the basis for reaching the decision. Is that their order or is that TSC? I mean, is any of this ever properly before the district court? The procedures that are followed, the order that the criteria that originates the investigation, the procedures that are followed to make the determination and the ultimate issue all would presumably be the result of TSA's authority under statute, 114H to do these things?
Well, that's a great question. I'm glad you brought up the distinction, because the district court held only that the substantive decision to keep someone or remove someone from the no-fly list was TSA's, and therefore a challenge to the substantive decision belongs under 46.110, the jurisdictional provision. It did not hold that it applied to the procedural for some of the same reasons that you're identifying here, which is that not all of the aspects of the procedure were necessarily controlled by TSA. For example, sometimes what's turned over, whether something's classified, that really derives from the originating intelligent portion of the intelligence community rather than TSA. So that is why the district court reached the merits of the procedural question, including the vagueness question and the due process question, but didn't reach the merits of the substantive question, because that was where TSA makes a substantive decision, which result in a different answer jurisdictionally.
Couldn't you then argue that in light of the role that TSC and the other organizations have in doing all of the legwork on this really makes TSA's decision at the end, if not just perfunctory, so still intertwined with their participation that there is jurisdiction for the district court to consider the substantive due process claim?
Well, no, I don't think that there's anything in the record to indicate that there's sort of a rubber stamping here. And certainly when it was the other way around in Ibrahim and Lateef, nobody asked whether TSC, which was getting information the other way around, was doing rubber stamping. The only thing the court asked...
Did they ever say, in even though TSC recommended someone be on the no-fly list, that they were taking them off?
I'm not aware of that, but you can certainly see in the record, both in the unclassified material and in the ex parte, sort of what is communicated.
All right. So since the district court dismissed that part of it, is it before us now?
Well, there's not actually any sort of petition under 46.110. As we said in our brief, if there was a timely one filed, we wouldn't object under the 60-day. Because we think that there's a good cause exception that's in the statute. I think the court would have a lot of discretion on whether it wanted to consider it as sort of under its jurisdiction at this point, and I wouldn't necessarily oppose that. I think the proper procedure ought to be to have a petition filed, but I think the court has a lot of discretion with that.
All right. Thank you. All right. We've taken you over, and we took you over. So I'm going to give you 2 minutes. Can you address that jurisdictional issue for us?
Certainly, Your Honor. And with respect to the jurisdictional issue, the material parts of the process remain the same in that TSA and TSC still have a unique relationship in which TSC is making most of the most important decisions up until the TSA administrator's final decision. I think it's important to emphasize that we asked the government for stipulations and information about the TSA administrator's access to information that the TSC had and whether that would happen, whether the TSA administrator had actually sought it, and the government refused to stipulate to that. We didn't get jurisdictional discovery on that. And this court in both Ibrahim and in Lateef back in 2012, when thinking through the jurisdictional issues, was very focused on what kind of remedy it would be able to provide. And right now, given this process, the court would not be able to seek additional information from TSC. Nor would the court, as this court just decided 2 weeks ago in the FICRE case, be able to prevent TSC from putting plaintiffs back on the list for reasons that hadn't ever been disclosed before. And very quickly, Your Honor, to address just a couple of other concerns that you have all raised. None of the purported allegations against our clients reflect unlawful behavior. And I think that's very important to keep in mind because they've never been charged with a crime in the years over which they've been investigated. And so they are still unsure what it means to pose a threat because none of that behavior is prohibited. It all is far short of the prohibited terrorism crime that we haven't challenged. Judge Benjivengo, the criteria and the process can be changed at any time. And in fact, as we saw over the course of the case, the process and the information about it changed with each declaration that the government provided, again, because none of this has actually been codified. Judge Callahan, your question about witnesses and confidential informants, this is something that, again, courts are used to dealing with and can be dealt with in SEPA-like procedures. There can be proffers of information made. There can be stipulations that are provided in other contexts that do not require the categorical kinds of secrecy concerns ruling out any kind of meaningful process. And with respect to SEPA, my colleague in the government talked about how the government could choose to do it. Well, the government chose not to provide SEPA-like proceedings in the Guantanamo habeas litigation. And in that context, the courts ruled that the government had to be able to provide that information. And I understand that those are liberty interests with deprivation of liberty. But what I think is really important is if the courts are willing to provide that process to people who are non-citizens, have no contact with the United States, and have been declared enemy combatants, then surely our clients who've never been charged with any violent crime should get more process than what they have received now.
Right. Just one second. Okay. Do either of my colleagues have any additional questions?
No.
Okay. So now that I guess what I need to ask everyone now at the end of it, did we say anything that can't be streamed? All right. And also, too, when we went outside the presence of, and I was setting out the procedures, is there anything there that anyone would have any difficulty of streaming that, the entire process? All right. So then what I'm going to order them to do at this point, then they can do it for live streaming. And so, okay. Thank you. This matter is submitted. If for any reason, if depending on the nature of what we have to look at, if there's any reason that we have to contact either of you or both of you, we will do so. Thank you.
Thank you.